Let's kind of review for a moment a kind of theme that's working through the room. And you might be, maybe with a little time, a little lunch, another centering of, in the silence, you may be a little restless with Merton at this point. He may sound a little too rambunctious or too, you know, something kind of wrong with him maybe. I'm not sure what you're thinking. I want to assure you that he experienced quite a lot of problems, and I'm going to refer to a couple of them and kind of breakthroughs that he made in the 50s in dealing with these. It wasn't an easy road for him, but we began today in thinking about the need to see clearly, and contemplation almost always for so many writers and for those of us experiencing it, there's a kind of visual metaphor. There's something about seeing what you're saying, seeing what you're thinking, seeing what you're believing, seeing the road ahead of you. Something about sight and the problem of blindness is just permeates our faith, our tradition. Seeing the road clearly for Merton was seeing reality, but never the whole gamut. It was just seeing something real in a world that was by and large kind of fake or false or not complete or not open or however we could kind of think of it. And so this led him to be very concerned about being attentive to whatever was real and to see clearly what is real. That attention, he started to realize, was a troubled kind of thing because of what he had to break through in seeing, that there was something that clouded his vision, his understanding, his experience. And almost always it was himself. So we're always in the way of ourselves and experiencing what is the closest thing to ourselves and the very reason for our existence as a self, which we call God, the life of our life. Merton experienced a lot of struggle in breaking through himself. And we're going to kind of deal with this a little bit today, even to the point of realizing that he's a human being. Because when he became a monk, he began to kind of think almost otherworldly of himself. And it was a breakthrough for him when he realized that he was a human being like every other human being, that he was not something different, this monk creature. He was actually this fuller kind of human being. This was an amazing thing for him. It opened up the entire world in a completely new way. And I'll come to that in a little bit. So he's trying to see clearly. He's trying to be attentive. Something inside of him that he's not really been prepared and grounded or oriented for, he's experiencing. Somehow our experience of the world that we live in is experienced not somewhere out there, but it's experienced inside of ourselves. This is a beautiful mystery. It's a paradox that my experience of everyone and everything outside of me is not experienced outside of me. It's experienced inside of me. It's almost as if everything outside, if you could, is this making any sense, or am I just, ooh, he's getting kind of loony now. When I talk to my wife is inside of me. My kids are inside of me. When I talk to students just doing my job, not talking about spiritual things, they're outside, I can see, they're distant from me. But somehow there's an identification that occurs in me. So if I'm trying to help a student understand something, they're asking me a question, I don't merely sympathize, and I'm not putting myself as a model. I'm saying this is work. I don't sense that I have some answer that I throw at them. Somehow I have to take the question in myself. Somehow I have to understand what they understand. Somehow I have to puzzle about what they're puzzling. It has to be inside of me as well as outside of me. Later in Merton's last year, he was giving some talks in Asian countries, and he had a beautiful line in one of his talks where he said, "Brothers, we are already one, but we think we're not. We're already in communion with each other, with God, with reality." And he's talking to people who are not necessarily even Christians. But we think we're not. What confuses us? What breaks us off? What distances us? What cuts us off from others? What makes our inside seem like it doesn't have anything to do with what's going on outside in the world? Merton didn't really believe that it was all apart, that we're all separated and we're trying to connect. we're really all united, and we're trying to understand that, affirm that. And somehow we're even trying to express that communion through our life, the life of our life pulsating, communicating itself through us. So somehow the interior of ourselves has everything to do with the interior of reality, the interior of other people. Not psychologically what's going through their head necessarily, but somehow the life that is in them is shared with the life that is in us. And he slowly began to really not just perceive it, but to experience it. And so he says, if I can flip to this, I don't know if I can find it quickly, I didn't mark it. But it's a beautiful line in here. I've got it memorized, so I don't even need the book. But I'd like to look at it again. He says, my life is a listening. This is in Thoughts and Solitude again. My life is a listening. And he's writing this in midway point in his monastic life. His life is a listening. And then he says, his is a speaking. This is the rhythm he starts to understand. He's a monk. He's trying to be quiet. He's trying to hear God. He's trying to find out who he is. He has to be quiet. He has to hear something. He doesn't know what he's going to hear. So he has to be open. He has to be attentive. He has to be spiritually sensitive to whatever. These are what he called seeds of contemplation. They're floating, like dandelion seeds through the air, those whirly bird helicopters, we call them, in maple trees that, you know, spin and rotate as going down. Seeds of contemplation are flying everywhere. Pay attention to all of these. You never know when one of these seeds is it just opens up the entire world. Is this not what William Blake said? You can see the whole world in a grain of sand. This was his master's thesis. He already understood this. Before he became a Catholic, he's already realizing that the whole world is inside the smallest thing. Like a mustard seed, or, you know, like oneself. So my life is a listening. His is a speaking. My salvation is to hear and respond. To me, that's the rhythm of contemplation and action. Contemplation is receiving the life that I already am, but I'm imbued with it. That thing is just coming through me, and I'm going to keep living. I have to face my death because that's part of my living. I have to face the realities of work and family and social issues. Merton comes to understand that as contemplative activity, not contemplation set apart from the world that's a mess, but contemplation right in the heart of things, because if there's any place where we need to be receiving God, it's right in the heart of what we're calling the real world, where we get messes and problems. So my salvation is to hear and respond. For this, my life must be silent. Hence, my silence is my salvation. I don't know why I didn't put this on the handout. This is a better quote than maybe some of the other ones. It is a perfect quote. But this whole book, you can't sit this down and read this in one sitting or a couple months or a year. You read a page like this and you have to put it down. Cornel West, well, often talking about books, he's an African-American philosopher, also a Christian, and he'll talk about when you're reading a book, and it starts to get inside your soul, and it starts to do havoc with you. It's turning your life upside down. This is the upheaval that Merton's talking about. And he says, you have to put that book down. You can't take it. You can't take anymore. You got to throw the book against the wall. It's just too much. It's just too much. Well, that's kind of, to me, that's like going to the ocean, going into the forest. I mean, when you start to come into a sense of the communion, the fullness of life, which, you know, is what Christ promised us. It's too much. Just a little dab will do. You remember that from the 60s commercial? Dippity doodah or something. What was that? Was it what? Dippity doo? Yeah, not dippity doodah. It was something else. But, Brill cream. Okay. So you guys go back a little bit. Okay. There was something else there. Women didn't do it. I thought men used Brill cream. What did women unscrew the little jar top that had, it's like bubbly. Was that dippity do? Okay. And there's Slinky, and we could go on. That's not our real life. But that's part of it. That's part of the fun. Now let's go to this Merton quote for a moment. No, let's don't. Let's look back at his life, and let me tell you about two events that are really key, and then let's look at what he says about silence and try to regather some things here. I think I want to move off of those monastic years and turn the page over to the other side of that, Merton Chronology, Section 3. We'll kind of work from there, the final two conferences this afternoon, when Merton kind of turns toward the world. What is beautiful to kind of start to see, if you don't already know this about Merton, is one of the draws that he is for us seems to be because he is... Was that me? It was I'm just sensitive. I don't want to cause any problems. I'm always scared I'm going to. Merton doesn't have any. He doesn't have any grounding. Remember, he loses his family, no church upbringing, doesn't have any direction, orientation. Just kind of lost in the world. This is kind of the way we are until we have some type of conversion, and then we make a turn, and then we enter something. This is a classic mystical stages, if you study the mystical way. Purgation, leaving the world, withdrawing from the commotion, however we could look at it. And then you go into the illuminative stage when your insides are opened up and things are bright. And then there's a third stage where you come out of solitude and you come back into, you reemerge in relations with others in your life. It's like you have to leave yourself. You have to die to yourself. And then you find yourself, and then somehow you have to find the way to live the way you are. It's the second birth. It's another baptism. We're familiar with this trajectory. Well, Merton's life exemplifies this perfectly. He's in the world lost, and then he finds his place, and then he loses his place, and then he has to learn how to live in this place, and he learns how to live there behind walls. And he is reopened to the entire world that he left. He wanted to be a writer. He quit. He wasn't going to write anymore. And then they told him to write. And then they told him to write stuff that he had never planned to write. And he wrote stuff he had no idea was in him. And he literally affected people all over the world. But he learned to engage that world through his writing, which he had no plans to do. And so it's kind of like you have to die to yourself. You take on a new role, a new life, maybe even a new name. But it's your real name. This is what you're supposed to do. He wanted to be a writer, and that was his plan for his life. God had another plan. He did not see it. He went with it. Didn't have much to go on, but he followed it. But that happened to be what he was supposed to do. But he didn't know it ahead of time. And we're all kind of in that boat. We've still got years ahead of us. But even when we die and we pass from whatever we're in, we are promised and assured that this just keeps on going. So the more we can realize as much as we can here, I mean, our contemplation is going to be perfected when we get to heaven. And heaven might just be this again. I don't know what it's going to be. I have no idea. But I'm open to something way beyond me, and it's not a distant thought or concept. It is something that I can sense inside of me now. I'm already in this livingness that just keeps going. So in the 50s, Merton is pretty quiet. He's recovered the Cistercian tradition. He's discovered the Desert Fathers. He's discovered the patristics. He's getting the theology that he never had. He's reading everything. He's reading everybody. He was a voracious reader. And he's making notes. He made methodical notes like crazy. Out of these notes came these books, his thoughts, as his world opened up. But he was a very bookish person. But he knew it wasn't in books. Whatever he was getting, it wasn't in the book. The book was this way to tap into something else. Well, he's starting to become so vivacious as a monk that he's starting to appear a little crazed to his superiors and some of the brothers. And they're starting to worry that he's getting a little too excited about what he's writing about and saying. And they're actually literally thinking that he is starting to crack up in a psychological way, almost as if maybe he's somewhat neurotic or psychotic. Now, in the 50s, we're sort of just, Freud's sort of catching up with us. We're starting, if you remember those times where we start to kind of discover psychology, and then we all kind of become kind of pop, amateur psychologists in the 70s, the me decade, and self-help books arrived, but we're already starting to think there's something about our minds not quite right. What about our parents? We're starting to wonder about therapy and all of this. This is really live stuff in the 50s. Well, Gethsemane doesn't know anything about this. Their sense of spiritual psychology comes from this long tradition. It does not come from Freud. Merton starts to get really interested in psychology. And he wants to go meet, at the time, a very famous psychologist named Zurchberg, who was in New York. Well, the abbot was thinking the same thing. You do need to go see a psychologist. I think there's something wrong with you. And they get I got to think of his name. He's still alive, a monk in, I think he's a Genesee now. He was a good close friend of Merton's. Became an abbot. Maybe it'll pop in when I quit thinking. So the abbot told Merton, I'm going to go introduce you to this guy. We're going to go hear a speaker, a theologian or something. We're going to take a little trip and your friend who's going to be my sort of co-spy is with me in on this. And what we're actually going to do is send you to the psychologist, put you on the couch and let him see what he thinks. Well, this is in the mid-50s, mid-56, 57 and they go, and Merton's very excited because he wants to, what is this psychology? I need to know about this. And he goes and the guy asks him questions. He tells, what he's thinking, what he's experiencing. And this is the man that told Merton, you are the most egotistical person I've ever met in my life. You want to be a hermit, but you want to be on Times Square. You want to have your hermitage in the middle of the world, neon lights, everybody looking at you. You're full of yourself. Now, partly, he has fed this, the psychologist has fed this kind of awful interpretation from some of the things that the abbot is kind of worried about. But the abbot doesn't know if he can actually psychoanalyze Merton, but he's concerned about him. And Merton is even talking about cracking up. What's happening is the spirit's busting through him. He's like a horse in a corral, and he's kicking every plank, and he's knocking over people, and he's just so excited, and they're trying to contain him. This is not monkish behavior. The horse bucking everyone. So they take him, and the psychologist assails him, just ridicules his character, mocks his whole monastic pretense, because it wasn't the normal monkish routine. And Merton has he breaks down in tears. It's one of the most moving parts of his journals, his private journals we got a hold of later on. He didn't have his journals published until 27 years after his death. And someone's watching it. Okay, it's 27 years. Boom, go. And then they just started publishing those things as quickly as they could. And people just read these things. Even brothers who were still at the Gethsemane monastery were amazed at what they were reading. What he was going on inside of him psychologically as well as spiritually, they had no idea. And his soul was in tremendous tumult. And he felt like maybe he should leave the monastery. Maybe he is cracking up. And maybe he's making this stuff up. He's experiencing something so real, and he's not getting confirmation from anyone around him, that he's thinking he's literally losing his mind. But he still doesn't really think so. And he's got to keep listening. He's got to keep paying attention. And what happens, he has a breakdown in terms of tears and confession, and he admits maybe the psychologist is right, and maybe I should get some help. I'm open to that. I mean, he was humiliated, if you read it. But he took the spiritual depth of the experience and was humbled by the humiliation itself. And it's an amazing kind of time for his life. Where the joke is on everybody, because then the other monk, I wish I could remember his name. It's John Eudes Bamberger, thank you. John Eudes Bamberger, Father John Eudes. Maybe some of you, know him. He's a very interesting. Wrote a nice book about Evagrius, one of the desert monks. John Eudes was then sent because it seemed important to study psychology. They sent him to Rome to go get a PhD in psychology and then come back. And this is often some of the monks would be sent off to get educated on something and bring it back and teach the community. So John Eudes went and got a degree in psychology, came back, and as far as he could tell, Merton was actually okay. And the father, Dom James Fox, had a turnaround as well. You're not cracking up. You're really on to something. I'm going to kind of pay attention to what it is you're saying. It's like a light came on in a dark place almost, or a flower cracked up through asphalt. Somehow Merton brought some new life in. Young monks were coming in, young novices, students in droves. And then they started to create sister houses. It's a Holy Spirit in Conyers, Georgia, Mepkin in South Carolina. These are sister houses of Gethsemane. They just mushroomed after World War II, and particularly after Merton. And now Merton's gone, and then that kind of that movement is kind of lessening, and some of the houses are a little lower. But this was a tremendous experience, but it was a blow to Merton's psyche in the normal, rational kind of sense, to where he was so confused about the spiritual experience of God in himself as possibly being conflated with this torment of his own mind, what he was doing to himself. And he wanted to know the difference. He couldn't resolve this himself, so he kept pressing on. He kept going. Second breakthrough is the most famous one. It's called the Fourth and Walnut Experience. How many people are familiar with that? Have you heard it? You've heard about that, right? This is probably the most famous Merton story. It's 1958. He goes to Louisville. There's a part two that's kind of funny about this, but he's in town, one of the normal kind of runs to see a dentist or something to pick up some supplies for the monastery. Merton, of course, did not drive because nobody trusted him driving, so he always rode with somebody. They're in town, and he's walking downtown in the good old days of when you went shopping or to work, you went downtown in the city. And so he's downtown Louisville at the corner of 4th and Walnut, which is right in the center of the very, very active downtown. It's now called 4th and Muhammad Ali, because Ali is from Louisville. So at 4th and Walnut, Merton is looking at all the people, all the secretaries walking by, all the executives walking by, salespeople in their briefcases, people going to lunch, just the routine work traffic moving through a city like ants, and he's dazzled by what he sees. And he looks at all these people, and he has this incredible experience that they're all shining like the sun. And he's thinking, how can you tell them? He senses this, but he knows he can't go up to, you know, excuse me, do you know you're shining like the sun? Could you please hold it down? He knows he can't communicate that. But how could you communicate that? How can you tell people that this resplendent glory is pulsing through them? It's coming out. It's emitted everywhere, this light. And they don't necessarily know it, and they're not privy to that. How do you tell them this is going on in you? I sense it. Well, he didn't tell them, but he had this breakthrough in his ability to see this or sense it. And it wasn't like seeing auras. He sensed the gravity of this was that he sensed that he was a human being. He saw everybody shining like the sun, and he realized that he was human just like them. The gloriousness of God was shining through these perfectly ordinary, non-monastic, non-religious human beings just going about their business on the sidewalk, and they're just radiating the light of God. And he realized this is what he most wants to be, not radiating light, but human. He realizes he's a human being. He's like everybody. And for him, following this really tough experience with a psychologist named Zilchberg, is life transforming for Merton. He realizes he's a human being. He's more in communion with everybody now. Everything he's been studying has been coming through him, and that he's sensing this experience that he's writing about. This is truth itself. It's truth incarnate, and it's in everywhere, and we are connected to everybody. And it wakes him up to everything that's going on in the world is important now. Before, he had shut the world off. Party boy goes, off to the monastery, not to look back. He'd turn into a pillar of salt. Well, he goes back, and then he comes out in the world, and he realized, I'm in this whole world. I'm not enclosed by the monastery. My life is connected to everybody around. And this just starts to grow and grow in him. And he starts, his correspondence really beefs up with people all over the world in all kinds of cultures and other languages. And he cannot get enough of connecting with people all over the place. You read his letters, it's astounding one, that he would have the boldness just to write somebody who was famous or just did something. But if they had any realness about them, he wanted to be in contact with that. And these two experiences really marked the 50s. The 50s is when he writes Thoughts in Solitude. Early in the 50s, before the psychologist incident, he writes these very quiet, very wise sayings. But it doesn't get published till after he's had this Fourth and Walnut experience, and the whole book has a new meaning at this point. Those two kind of watershed, normal human being kinds of experiences, I guess kind of landmark perspectives, landmark experiences for his spiritual perspective in the 50s. So let's look, what has any of this got to do with silence? So let me read this on our second blue page, Conference 3, Silence. This paragraph comes a little further in the book. Solitude has to be objective and concrete. Now let me stop for a second. Keep this Fourth and Walnut experience in mind. He's thinking that solitude in the earliest days was actually away from everybody. He comes to realize that solitude, spiritually deeply understood, has to do with communion with everything. Because when you go into solitude, you go into the depth of your life in silence, which is rooted in God, which is where everything else that exists, that has possibility of existing, it's all in God. So when you go into solitude to meet God alone, you actually come and find yourself in contact and communion with everyone and everything else. And it's got to be real, which is why he's saying solitude has to be objective and concrete. It has to be a communion in something greater than the world, as great as being itself, in order that in its deep peace we may find God. We put words between ourselves and things. Even God has become another conceptual reality in a no man's land of language that no longer serves as a means of communication with reality. The solitary life, being silent, clears away the smoke screen of words that man has laid down between his mind and things. In solitude, we remain face to face with the naked being of things. And yet we find that the nakedness of reality, which we have feared, is neither a matter of terror or shame. It is clothed in the friendly communion of silence, and this silence is related to love. When we have really met and known the world in silence, words do not separate us from the world, nor from other men, nor from God, nor from ourselves, because we no longer trust entirely in language to contain reality. That's a big statement for a writer to make, that reality is not contained in language. That's all you got to work with if you're a writer. Yeah.
Did you? In this book, it says God has become another conceptual unreality. You have reality.
Your paper.
Oh, do I?
And the book says unreality.
Well, I'm going to have to go with the book on this. I'm trying to find where have I got fourth line. Let's see. Said 85 in your book?
Yes. Second paragraph from the bottom.
Well, I'm already going to invest all my money in Merton here if I've...
Even God has become another conceptual unreality.
Oh, I see what you... Which we... yeah. I'm still trying to find where I... Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a... another conceptual reality. It is a conceptual unreality. That was a slip of my own thinking and typing. It's so easy for. I'm glad you pointed out the mistake. It's really a good one to. It's a good one to celebrate for a minute. Let's just thank her for showing this, because the for Merton, reality is not conceptual. So particularly God. So a concept is something that we form, and we can have concepts of reality. It's certainly fine. But what he's talking about here, another conceptual unreality, is often what we confuse with our own concepts of reality. And so he's always kind of bracing himself against his own tendency to conceptualize his experience, which turns unreality into reality, then we think we're confronting or facing or living reality itself. Does that make sense? I don't know if I'm getting out of the hole of my typing. But I would have made that mistake. That would have been a mistake because I would have understood what that's what we do. We conceptualize reality, but it's another conceptual unreality. An unreality is almost a conceptual reality for Merton. If you put this into context with that, from the reference to Forth and Walnut, Merton is experiencing these people. He's in solitude, and he's not talking to them, but he feels like he's in communion with them. And he would like to communicate with them, but it's a question. How can you tell people they're shining like a sun? Is he conceiving this? Is that the reality? If you went up to them, they would say, I don't see that. See that. So when we have spiritual experiences and we take them to be real, it creates a real communication puzzle for us, which means you can back up into Merton's earlier thought in the 50s where he can't tell the difference between his own mind and his own spirit, or his own mental confusion and digressions in his own spiritual progress. How do you tell the difference? The trap is we can't really tell the difference. But the breakthrough here for Merton is that he senses a reality that's larger than himself that he could not have conceptualized. And he attributes that to what solitude gives you. And he attributes that to what silence brings you, which was why we would want to center ourselves in silence. But you know, the battle for us when we're centering in prayer is the mind just jumping and conceptualizing and making up things and distracting us. And we'll come back to that in a moment. Am I making more unsense? If we can do reality and unreality, it can be unsense and sense. Then there's common sense, and then there's uncommon sense, and then there's nonsense, and that's kind of what I like to. So how do you write in the last sentence? How do you continue being a writer when you no longer trust entirely in language to contain reality? Merton's writing started to change after this point. After he realizes that anybody who's reading his books, it's not a private audience anymore. It's not people just interested in a certain kind of spin on the Catholic tradition. He starts to write about all kinds of things. Vietnam War, racism, economics. And people start to pay attention to what he's saying about issues. Now, this is where he starts to get in trouble. Because now, again, he's bucking a kind of system or a conceptualization of how people should be. And he's getting unmonk-like now. So we realize he's sane now. He's okay. Merton's got a check. He's passed the psychology test. But now he's gone social. And he's getting out into the world. And when he starts to say some things about the Vietnam War, the Abbot General of the Order says, you can't write about that anymore. Now, Merton was very obedient. The abbot said that when he retired, that Thomas Merton was the most obedient monk that was ever under him, under his guidance. So Merton is sort of framed and presented as someone who bucked the system his entire life, and he kind of did, but he didn't reject it. He was just always thinking and saying and wanting to others to understand that there was more to it. It's like we're shining like the sun. Let's don't box this up. Is that not what Christ is talking about? Don't hide your love under a bushel. I mean, Merton is just so slowly but solidly finding out what Christ is talking about in the Beatitudes, all the way through all of the parables, and he's wanting to communicate this. But then he comes under this really hard place now, where he's going to have to talk about issues, and this is where his contemplation and the action starts to become really problematic for some people. And they want to divorce the two. But all of Merton's, I would argue, because I can argue, you can argue back. But all of Merton's so-called activist writings, to me, are very contemplative writings. They are not activist writings from someone who takes a political position, adopts some kind of ideological stance, and then makes a claim about one way or the other. It is because of his contemplative experience of receiving God's life that he is responding to that, that he cannot make sense of things like war, racism, economic injustice. And he starts opening up his communication with all kinds of people, and we'll pick that up on the final conference. Martin Luther King Jr., by the way, which I'll come back to, planned to retreat at Gethsemane to spend time with Merton. He thought that they had a lot in common because of some of the things Merton was saying and thinking. But I'll come back to that. How are we doing on time? I think our afternoon session is a little shorter, aren't they? 50 minutes? Let me stop for a second and let's... would anybody like to ask something or... Well, make a comment, either on this quote of silence or where we're headed or something. I'm going to get back to the biography, a few more things in the 60s, but I was kind of covering the late 50s there.
I didn't hear what you said. Did you say that he did meet with Martin Luther King or Jr. or not?
Well, that was a teaser for the stay for the fourth conference.
Okay.
I'll tell you about that. He planned to.
Deep.
Yeah.
I'm almost getting the feeling he was almost like a mystic.
Well, he was. He was. But, you know, one of the problems with... I'm glad you brought that up because it's a good time to talk about that for a second. There are different perspectives of mystics. There have been for centuries. Some writers will talk about mystics as having mystic experiences. Merton just didn't think like that. That's not what... A mystic was someone who was in tune with... communion with reality, who knew the oneness of God that permeated all of creation, because everything that was made by God. From a Christian perspective, a Buddhist perspective could say the same thing in different kinds of terms, different kind of doctrines even, but there'd be this sensibility that there was this oneness. Greek philosophers 3,000 years ago sensed that everything was the same thing, but it was always changing. So there have been mystics throughout the centuries who have experienced this interconnectedness of life so profoundly that sense or that sensibility threatened other people who cut the world up, divided it, controlled it, turned into we know this, we don't know that, those kinds of things. And so mystics always kind of threaten or rub some people the wrong way, but he's a mystic in the last year of his life. I was going to kind of come to this a little later, but when he talks to the Buddhists and he meets the Dalai Lama, this is the same Dalai Lama that's the current Dalai Lama, but he met him when he was much younger, and they just identified with each other. They had nothing was arranged. They haven't written to each other. They met and they could talk and they understood what each other was talking about. And they had a translator because he didn't speak the language. But they loved each other. How do you explain that attunement, that kind of communion? That's mystical. So when the Dalai Lama comes to the United States and he wants to have dialogue with Christian monks, put them in conversation with Buddhist monks, where does he go in the world? He goes to Kentucky, he goes to Gethsemane, where Thomas Merton had his home, and he wanted to have dialogues, and they've had three there that I know of, and no plans to stop. And in fact, it was some of the contemplative monks that began another organization of intermonastic dialogue because they sensed communion. And this is Merton's last words in his life is about, we already want, but we don't think we are. What is that thing that's knocking it out? Call it commotion, the racket, our inner noise, our false confidence in ourself, a false conceptualization of what is right and true according to our cultural upbringing, language, bent of mind, or whatever. So a mystic sees all that and understands all of that is in place, and it's all kind of natural, but you have to go through it. You have to grow through that. And his way, not a technique, because it's silence. It's silence. Well, silence gives you the common ground in which you can then commune or communicate with someone in another tradition, another language, another culture, another race. Because it's these words that separate us. So that's what he's talking about here. And that's a mystical, I would argue, that is the mystical sense. But it gets you in some hot water. Because as soon as you say that, well, then how are we going to do this? And how are we going to organize this? And how do you get people to... Well, you can't go preach this. Okay, everybody wake up. Well, what are you talking about? Define your term. I mean, we're already lost. But how does this get communicated? Burton was learning it. His whole life was a listening. So he's picking it up constantly. Well, a mystic will do that. They're listening to God no matter where God is speaking. Jesus said it himself when he said, look at those flowers. Look at the birds. Pay attention. What am I saying here? Do you know who I am? Disciples, well, duh, I don't, you're the one, aren't you? It took them for the longest time. And then he dies and I told you, and he resurrects and then they start to get it. Then they try to tell the rest of the world. And that's we're in that boat. It's a tough one.
Great. And when I'm listening to you, sometimes we think of concepts as kind of defining reality, but they don't define, they point to reality.
Yeah.
And as long as we're allowing the reality to be bigger than the concept, we're in pretty safe grounds, I think. At least safer grounds than we usually are.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. There's a peacefulness, too. Some of us were talking at lunch a little bit about this kind of problem, where forms and concepts kind of take the place of reality, or they point to reality. There's a way of making peace with, and kind of a way of accepting yourself and facing yourself when you realize that all you've got is your language and your thoughts, but there's something more to you, and this is all you've got. I mean, this conference and this talking and these handouts and these books, they're all pointers. They're all pointers to the reality. They're not the thing. They're pointing to the thing. Our kids point to the thing. Our world and all of its problems point to what we're, you know, but we can't name it. In the Old Testament, it says you can't name God. There's no name for that. We can't even conceptualize. So one of the best things I think we can do sometimes as Christians is to make it easier for each other to admit that we really don't know who or what God is. Now, this is not reckless or irreverent. Please don't misunderstand me. When you're safe enough to be able to say, I really don't know what or who God is, not in the way I understand that Abraham Lincoln was the 16th president of the United States, that's knowledge. This is something different. Faith tells me that. There's an assurance, there's an understanding there. But I don't know that. As soon as I can say I don't know and possess and have that, I'm kind of open at that point. And that allows someone else to be kind of open too. And then we're going to be listening. Then we're receiving something if we can respond. I'm sorry.
Yes, I'd like to make a remark in reference to what before lunch someone brought up a question about the sense and feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it seems like Thomas Merton, he was similar to a mystic because he got that inner depth. He got down into that inner depth of the mystery of God. Because I read somewhere, I don't know if it was Thomas Keating or who I read, that once you get into that inner depth of the realization of God, or whatever you want, the center of God, or whatever you want to call it, but that's what the Holy Spirit is doing, is giving you that peace and that wisdom. But, you know, I can't quote who it was that I read it from, but he says, once you get into contemplation or centering prayer and you get into that center, could have been St. Teresa of Avila, I don't know, because I've read quite a few, but it said that the Holy Spirit, that's when he awakens you and tells you, mm-hmm. he is almost sanctifying you or purifying you at that moment.
Yeah. But, you remember...
What do you have to say to that?
Well, these are great people. Teresa Avila, I mean, one of her first instructions about prayer is, before you pray, think who it is you're talking to. I love that. That's a check. I will remember that quite a bit. Don't think you know what you are doing. And it's not just a confidence thing. It's you better be utterly respectful and mindful of who you're about to address. Do not be cocky and, another thing. I want this to happen. she used some terms kind of like royalty, almost like before the king. But we've got that from Scripture as well. St. Paul, we know this, backwards and forwards. The Holy Spirit prays. We don't know what to pray. We stumble for words. Holy Spirit prays in us. There's a beautiful book I'd recommend. It's a tough one. It's a tough writer. He died in 2010. He's a Spanish priest, Spanish mystic. Ramon Panacar, with two K's. Who's familiar with this guy? This guy is, okay, great. This guy is just, he liked Merton. He quoted Merton, but he quoted all kinds of people. He almost, before he died, he had agreed to come to the States to be the keynote speaker at a conference about Merton. And he was looking forward to it, but the conference planning just kind of fell apart. I was so excited about that possibly happening. He wrote a book called The Experience of God. And his argument very early in that book is that what we're calling the experience of God within us is really God's experience in us. The experience of God is God's experience in us. That's on the first page. Read that, and then the book is thin, but this is what Merton understood. When you go inside and you go into these depths, you're not going into your own depths. This is what they were worried about in the 50s. This is what they thought he was cracking up. Where are you going, Merton? You're going way down in the deeps. I don't know where I'm going, and no one can tell me what it is that I'm doing. Then they realized, boy, you went pretty far. And he tapped into not his own experience, but he tapped into God's experience of his life. And then you hear something. But then you gotta check yourself, because you know how quickly we can make it up what we want to hear. This is just one of our problems. Go ahead. Do you want to follow up?
Thomas Keating at that time?
Well, I can't. Basil Pennington knew Merton for sure. I don't know that. I don't think Keating actually met.
Oh, okay.
I may be wrong about that, but I don't think he actually met. Pennington definitely did. But I think Keating came in right after. At least on the contemplative kinds of things, right after Merton. In a personal way. I mean, he was certainly alive and thinking before that, but I'm not exactly sure.
Question here.
Thomas Merton, he's probably maybe in the top 10 of recognized Catholics. How would you assess Thomas Merton as a Catholic in his time, the time in which he was a Catholic, and in the present, as far as maybe his contribution towards the church right now?
Wow, that's a great question. Yeah. I can feel myself getting in trouble in answering it in some ways, and so I kind of want to be cautious, but I like being reckless too. But the one sense of, I don't know really how to answer, but one sense. When he's writing, even in the 60s, one of the popes wrote to Merton and said, could you write something on the contemplative life? The Vatican was paying attention to Merton as one of the world's monastic public voices. And so what he said had some weight. Merton, in following Pope John the 23rd, loved that Pope. And I did a review of some conferences, the audios that we listened to Merton. He did one right in early to mid-60s, right when the documents were getting leaked, before the Vatican II documents were out. He was getting things, because theologians and different people would send him stuff, because they valued his opinion. And he was, his voice, what shook me in listening was just his voice, how excited he was about the possible freshness of the church opening up, and the sense of the doors opening, the windows opening. He was so excited. He sounded like a kid, and he's a grown adult. He sounded like a kid. Oh, could this happen? Could this happen? Could we be this open? And he's singing in the leadership. So he is just ecstatic. Now, he wasn't so big on some of the, you know, guitar masses or getting rid of the Latin. He was kind of up and about that. But he was so excited about the possibility of, and will they let this happen? Will they keep it open? Or will they come down, or, you know, the people clamp down on it? The other thing at that time was the whole idea of Vatican II and the returning to sources. Well, Merton had already been doing that for 10, 15 years. He had already rediscovered the sources of his own religious order. And in doing that, he was returning to the sources of the Christian church. He was rereading the Gospels and the Pauline letters and the Desert Fathers and the early church fathers, Greek and Latin. And he was translating them, and he was writing commentaries all the way up to Bernard, the last of the fathers. So he had the official standard church structure and institution and history and culture in mind, with the excitement that this whole thing is going to open and all these great souls are going to be give voicing again, and that the church is going to have this spiritual awakening. He was very prepared for that, and he was consulted on these kinds of things. Now, what happened after his death until a few years ago? The negative side of the story is that the Catholic bishops of the United States put together a book. They wanted a popular book on the catechism. And they were going to do it. They were going to try to entice young people to, hey, how about the catechism? This is good stuff, really. Come on, read this. And so they wanted a book that would just get these young people kind of coming into the church and loving that catechism. And they decided they wanted to do it with personalities, with Catholic stars. And the first chapter was Thomas Merton. They thought, we got to start with Merton. And then there was an uproar among the bishops and some other parties outside and they complained that Merton shouldn't be the first chapter. That's going to throw people off. Some people have made the argument that young people don't even know who he is. But the problem with that argument, the rest of the book was full of a bunch of people nobody didn't know. Even priests and bishops didn't know who some of these people were. Dorothy Day made it in. But they went through an editorial kind of... This was in the last 10 years. This is in the last 10 years. They went through and Merton got cut. They went through a debate, and they took Merton out. Took him completely out. He was first chapter, and then he didn't move to 99. They took him out. The Merton Society, International Merton Society, wrote a very respectful letter to the bishop saying, that wasn't a great idea to do. A lot of kids know about Merton. He speaks a lively language. He's revered among all kinds of laity. This would be a great communicator for the church. So I don't know. When he was alive, he was getting respected. He had a voice. He was being consulted by popes, by theologians. He was reading them, and he was in concert with them. He was in discussions. They would send him documents that would later become publications. But then, kind of slowly, something has kind of happened, at least within our own... your question is so huge. I don't know. That would have been reckless to say. Does that even touch? You want to ask something to hone in a little bit?
No, that was very informative. Kind of in the line of, I thought, the way you might go. But also, I've read recently that many people in America consider themselves spiritual, but not religious.
Yeah.
Is there a sense in which Merton would be an outstanding figure in spirituality, but not so much in formal religion?
Yeah, oh, sure he would. And what's so good about him is that it's not an either-or. But he understands the distinction. He understands the trouble of it. He would certainly go with the spirituality. But then he says, if you follow that, that's going to put you back into the heart of the religion. That's the life of the religion. The religion without the spirituality is a shell. It's an empty, it's a concept. So he understood people that were constrained by religion and were not free to... And it's their sense of their own life being expressed, as well as the forms being expressive and communicative themselves. So he would definitely be, I can't think of anybody who would be better on that kind of question. Someone who is a Christian who is having a hard time with the church and are being told just to go back to church and get back into church. Read somebody such as Merton. There are other writers. But read somebody who's talking about spirituality, who understands that problem, that struggle. But who did not, some contemporary writers will go, I'm not religious, I'm just spiritual, and my religious form doesn't have anything to do with anything. The tradition, the culture, is irrelevant. That wasn't Merton's take. That's why he's so paradoxical. He seems liberal to some people, he seems conservative to other people. He wasn't trying to be one or the other. He wasn't trying to be in or out. He was just trying to follow something true. And so he wasn't going to chunk anything. That's why he was obedient as a monk, even though he's chomping at the bit for things to change. They were sleeping on straw when he went into the monastery. When he left, they had little mattresses. And that's what they have today. I mean, they made some changes. Because he asked questions like, "What is it more religious to sleep on straw? It's like, are we wailing ourselves? Is that what asceticism and, you know, Lent is?" He asked real quick, what's the real thing here? Let's do that. That's somebody who understood that distinction. That's the separation of our life from our life when we talk like that. That's where we've lost our contemplative receptivity of the life of our life when we make that demarcation between spirituality and religion. It's so understandable, though. I know we got to be at break time, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
We're going to take a very 10-minute break.
Okay, walk around, move around, get the blood flowing. We'll finish up.